Well, I'm very pleased to welcome you here on behalf of both Women in International Security and the U.S. Institute of Peace. I'm Pamela Aull. I'm Director of Education here at the Institute, but I am also lucky enough to be on the board of WISE. And we have a number of WISE people here. Probably the whole audience is WISE, but they're very officially WISE people here. And Gail Maddox, the president, is sitting over here. So we want to welcome WISE officially and get on with this very interesting panel. This topic of women and Islam is of great interest to many people, but at least in talking to people casually, people who are foreign affairs experts, etc., it's really not very well understood. And I got insight on this last night, in the middle of the night, as I was thinking about this panel, and I realized we're talking about women. We're talking about a huge diversity of people, and we're talking about Islam, which is a religion with any number of faces, and we're talking about both of them at the same time. So the complexity of this issue, I think we all need some help with, and we're very pleased to have such a good panel to help us untangle some of the issues that are before us. I'm going to turn the panel over to my colleague, Rich Kozlerich, my new colleague. He is new at the Institute, although he comes from the State Department, where he was for 38 years and was
32.
32 years.
It seemed like
32. Sorry. Was our ambassador to Bosnia and to Azerbaijan, and is now director of the new initiative here at the Institute, the Special Initiative on the Muslim World. So, Rich?
Well, Pamela, thank you very much. And I'm going to try not to be a panelist here, too, but I did want to say a few words of welcome and introduction. And I'm particularly pleased, Gail, that you've allowed this to happen, because I think it's a tremendous opportunity to demonstrate cooperation between the Institute and other organizations around here who share our same objectives and interests. So I think this is just a tremendous opportunity. The Institute has been involved not in a programmatic way, but in the Muslim world in a number of areas in the past. But since creating this initiative, we've now tried to bring some focus to what is a region that stretches from Mali to Mindanao. And we recognize that understanding, as Pamela mentioned, the complexities of this region requires people who are from the regions of the Muslim world to help us understand better what is going on. The Institute has been working with Women Waging Peace in terms of understanding the role of gender in areas of conflict. We're very pleased that work is underway now. But under the framework of our initiative on the Muslim world, we need to find better ways to grapple with these very broad concepts of human rights and democracy and media freedom and the role of women. And you know, I can talk about that as a former U.S. ambassador, but look at it very much from my own American Western perspective. And I think this is an opportunity for us to see the varieties of experience and how these issues are conceptualized from quite different perspectives. If I can introduce a little commercial here for those of you who are free tomorrow, we are going to have a very interesting program on Islam and democracy. David Smock, who's organizing that from the Institute's point of view, be at 10 o'clock, I believe. Sorry? 10 o'clock. But again, these two represent our ways of trying to come to grips with a complex and perhaps not well understood set of issues. We're trying to do this exploration of these issues not in a way that's based on stereotyping or assumptions that somehow the social system elsewhere is flawed in some respect, but rather how do we better understand how Muslim societies are dealing in this particular case with the changing role of women. And I think we've got a broad coverage. It's not a perfect coverage because we've missed out on a lot of different areas. And Dale and I were talking, maybe we can do some follow-up work and get other perspectives as well. But I think to see from the point of view of the Caucasus, Azerbaijan, Iran, from the Philippines, and from Iraqi Kurdistan, three quite different perspectives is really a great opportunity and one that I'm looking forward to. So I hope without making a speech, I've at least set the stage for what I hope will be a very rich discussion of this. And showing my favoritism from my previous experience, perhaps we can start with Nayira Tohidi. I will not go into the bios here, but Nayira is Associate Professor of Women's Studies at California State University, now at the Woodrow Wilson Center, doing some absolutely outstanding work on Azerbaijan and the role of women there, and I'm sure lots of other things as well. But why don't I turn it over to you to start with a short presentation, and we'll sort of work our way down the line here. And at the end of this, we'll open it up for questions from the floor. So, Nayira.
Very good. Thank you, Richard. And thank you, Pamela, and others for organizing this. I'm pleased to be here for the first time at the Institute, that I always followed your work and have been interested, and I'm pleased that now I get a chance to also get introduced to your WISE organization. So, well, I'm going to just introduce some issues and some suggestions in 20 minutes. I cannot do more than that. An ironic ramification of the tragedy of September 11 and the subsequent demise of the Taliban in Afghanistan seems to be an unprecedented prominence in the international scene of the question of women's rights and status in the Islamic world. This increased international attention to women's quest for equal civil and human rights and a better appreciation for women's agency in the modernization and democratization of the Islamic world can be a welcome development. The significance of this potentially positive turn is better appreciated when we bear in mind that if it were not for the outrage and protest widely expressed by the international feminist movements, especially the American feminists, and resistance of Afghan women themselves, the U.S. government, prompted by some oil companies, was getting ready to recognize the government of Taliban. Perhaps it had to take no less than the September 11 wake-up call for many politicians to speak out against the blatant violations of women's rights in Afghanistan. Because, again, the worldwide outcry against, for example, destruction of few statues in Bamiyan seemed to be wider and louder than the outcry against the violation of women's rights for years in Afghanistan under the Taliban and previous government of Afghanistan, the Mujahideen and so forth. Now, I'm wondering what strategies should women's rights advocates use to translate this probably short-lived risen attention of the Western leaders to the Muslim women's rights into a long-lasting, effective foreign policy and foreign aid issue on the part of the Western governments on the one hand, and the mobilization of new resources in support of Muslim women's grassroots activism that can render effective pressure on the governments and ruling elites inside the Muslim societies for concrete legal reforms and policy changes in favor of women's empowerment. First, I think we need to turn this reason and at times otherizing attention into a deeper awareness of the complexity of the Muslim women question, its commonalities as well as differences with non-Muslim women in the global context, and its historical roots and present interconnectedness to broader global, national, and socioeconomic and political problems. Is the woman question or the issue of women's rights in the Islamic world essentially different from the ones in other parts of the world? If you just, since my time is very short, I'm just skipping some parts of my paper, but if you look through some of the most recent reports about the state of women's rights and women's situation in the world, for example, the report by the UNDP or by the United Nations on the occasion of in commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was published in December 1998, or Human Rights Watch World Report in 2000, they all reveal that majority of women in different parts of the world, Muslim and non-Muslim, are still suffering from systematic trends of violence, inequality, discrimination, abuse, and neglect in the home, in the labor market, and society at large, especially in situations of civil war and inter-ethnic conflicts, in migrations and refugee camps, in networks of sexual trafficking, and in situations of honor killings, dowry killings, and genital cutting. It seems that the egalitarian changes that have taken place in many countries, even some of the legal reforms, have not always been translated in effective policies and effective practice in a broad sense. Many governments, Islamic or otherwise, refuse to recognize, let alone remedy, discriminatory laws, traditions, and practices that perpetuate the second-class status of women in many societies, cultures, and religions. For instance, many who have joined the CEDAW Convention, that you know, Convention Against Elimination of for Elimination of Any Discrimination Against Women, many governments, some Islamic governments as well, have ratified this convention only under the condition that they preserve some sections of this convention. So much so that it has neutralized the effect of the convention, because some of the items that they have reservation right are actually related to the whole purpose of the convention. That is equal rights for women. So that is the international state of women's rights. It's not that it's only in the Islamic world that we have problems. But still, it's undeniable that there are certain problems, certain, if not peculiarity, but intensity and magnitude in terms of disparity between men's and women's rights in the Muslim world that needs to be explained. And that has been, that problem has been especially sometimes exacerbated or distorted and misunderstood by the prevalence of veiled and downtrodden images of Muslim women in the international media, which has associated some peculiarity to the to Islam, and as if the Islam is essentially different from other religions when it comes to women's rights, and as if there is something essential about Muslim men who are more patriarchal than others, or something essentially unique to the Islamic civilization, which is more misogynist than others. So these are some of the misconceptions and otherizing that should be understood, should be discussed, because it kind of reduces women's status to one single factor, and that is religion, with disregarding socioeconomic factors, historical factors, political factors, and some cultural, local customs and norms that precede Islam and supersede Islam. And religion only is one factor, although very significant, especially in countries that it is still playing very significant role in politics and legal system, but nevertheless it is one factor that interplays with others in shaping women's status and women's rights. I'm arguing that, similar to what it said about the question of race, being the blind spot of democracy in the United States, it seems to me that in the Islamic world, gender has become the blind spot of democracy. I'm going to argue that the key with regard to intensity of disparity between male and female roles and rights and status in the Muslim world today is lack of democracy, democracy deficit, if you will, which goes back to defective process of modernization in these countries. Because historically speaking, I'm going to skip again part of the previous here. Historically speaking, women's subordination has not been peculiar to the Islamic world, nor has the differences in male-female rights in the Muslim world always been greater than the ones in Europe and other non-Muslim areas of the world. In pre-modern times, and in regard to ownership and inheritance, women actually had more rights in the Islamic world than in the Christian West. Actually, the gap between the non-Muslims and Muslims in terms of gender equality began to emerge in the 19th and 20th century with the emergence of modernity, industrialization, and liberal democracy in Christian Europe and North America. And it is those developments that place women, Western women, far ahead of women in the Muslim world in the path of equal rights and democracy. Many so-called Islamic customs, such as veiling, seclusion, and polygamy, go back to pre-Islamic civilizations. The replacement of hoe-based horticulture, in which women were the primary producer, with plow agriculture, in which men became the primary producers, is thought to have initiated a patriarchal social structure throughout Southwest Asia about 3,000 years BC. Once matrilineal, matrilocal family system was replaced with patriarchal one, as property and inheritance in the male line became important, control over female sexuality and issues such as female virginity and fidelity became central ideological concerns. Seclusion and veiling were then constructed prior to Islamic intervention as patriarchal devices to make women easier to control and help assure paternity. Evidence as early as the Assyrian legal texts of 13th century BC indicate that seclusion and veiling was practiced in pre-Islamic Persia, Iran, in the Byzantine Empire, and in the Greco-Roman world. Veiling was also, and sometimes still is, a sign of status and class, as for example, a respectable Athenian woman was usually secluded and veiled to signal that she's protected from sexual advances and that she's not so poor to need to go out to work or even to shop. Excuse me. When it comes to guarding girls and women from outside males, endogamy, cousin marriage, emphasis on female virginity and chastity, and deportments relating to honor and honor killing, other Mediterranean people had much in common with Muslims. These behavioral patterns have been attributed to topography of the region, the difficult terrain, mixed settlement, and the prevalence of tribal groups, the effects of which seeped into their cultures through centuries. Gender roles and gender relations among the Muslims vary due to ethnic and regional diversity. For example, Turkish and Mongol women usually did not wear the veil and exerted direct influence over major decisions and enjoyed a relatively more egalitarian gender relations. Considerable gender-related differences have also been observed in areas such as Southeast Asia, China, and Africa, where people converted to Islam gradually rather than being conquered by outside Muslims. These variations indicate that religion of Islam, like any other religions, is no is no single and pre-social entity, but operates only in a social historical context, in an interplay or interaction with local customs, socioeconomic and politics, political factors of any given time. Now, there were, of course, differences in intensity of whaling between European Mediterraneans and non-European ones, and also with regard to polygamy. But, of course, European men also, in practice, were rarely monogamous. So one then needs to explain this dramatic difference in gender relations and women's rights between Muslims and non-Muslims that come to emerge with the 19th and 20th century resistance to change among the Muslims, many of them exasperated by the current revival of Islamic traditionalism and Islamist ideology that push for retaining or reviving of old sexual mores and patriarchal norms. So instead of necessarily going and looking into Islamic scriptures that has been common to do for years in academia, and this much, you know, much emphasis on sexuality aspects of the issues, the point is that to understand what happened in the West, that women, what factors helped women who could resist the, who could overcome, at least to a better degree and more extensively than women in the Muslim world, against the forces of patriarchy, the traditionalism, and the ones who resisted changes toward egalitarian gender relations, and especially equal rights for women. So one then needs to go back and study these factors. What happened in the West? How was the process of modernization implemented that helped this process and a growing, very vigorous, vibrant women's movements, thanks to which women could gain equal rights? Because in the West, as we all know, modernity did not begin with equal rights for men and women. Even the slogans of, for example, Great French Revolution, liberty, fraternity, and justice, they meant just fraternity, men, brothers, not sisters. So it took years. When, for example, the Convention on Human Rights, the first declaration of the rights of man and the citizen in 1789, and of course citizen also was understood in male normative and masculine terms, or the U.S. Bill of Rights in 1791, when they were introduced, excuse me, a pioneer of women's rights, people like Mary Wollstonecraft, or even some men like John Stuart Mill, produced their own feminist counterpoints with regard to these masculinist, exclusively male normative human rights. And then we know that even in the United States, for example, the most modernized and advanced country in the West, women had to go to jail, like Susan B. Anthony, in order to get the right to vote. And it took until 1920 that women gained the right to vote. So, but what happens that Muslim women are still lagging behind in terms of these rights? So one needs them to go back to see what processes took place, socioeconomic and political, in the Western context that helped to reform the religion that was very patriarchal and was blocking the way, and the traditionalist forces, patriarchal forces. And this is, so my main findings in my studies is that it is the problem with the process of modernization and also the impact of colonialism in the Muslim world that has made resistance against modernity more more stronger, because the patriarchal forces, the traditionalists, especially the bazaar oriented middle class in the Middle East, for example, they could use they, although their motivation was actually many times to be anti-equality, anti-equal rights, and anti-women's rights, and anti-modernization in women's, in family structure and family functions, but because of association of modernity and modernization with the Western influence, with imperialism, with colonialism, they were successful to mix anti-imperialist, nationalistic sentiments of people and mobilize people against modernizers in those countries. And modernity, unfortunately, since it wasn't a kind of an indigenous, gradual, bottom-up process in these countries, but usually rapid, top-down, elitist, and state-centered, and externally oriented, with the intervention of foreigners and Westerners. It made then modernity and modernization associated with Westernization, with colonialism. That's why especially women then got caught, like their rights became a hostage in this identity politics and resistance. So women were, whenever they wanted to be modern, they were called Westoxicated and Westernized. Like an Iranian feminist in one of her writings is saying that these Islamists and traditionalists are not really traditionalists when it comes to, for example, use of technology or you know, lifestyle in many other ways. But when it comes to women's rights, they become very traditional and they want to stick to the old ways of life. And that is no wonder that many aspects of life in Muslim countries, like military, education, government, many institutions have been to some degree secularized and modernized. The only institution that has resisted and has been left to the Islamic Sharia is the family and the family law. And that is the area that traditionalists and, interestingly, modernists, with a kind of collaboration with each other, have resisted change and has been very hard to change. And again, this Iranian friend of mine says, men don't oppose if we cook good food in microwave, or you know, but when and that is Western. But when we say we want equal rights, they say, oh, you're talking like Western feminists. You are Westoxicated. So it shows this, you know, this hypocrisy and unevenness in the part, and how they are using the unlegitimate, illegitimate governments as an excuse to also delegitimize modernization projects of these governments. Therefore, what we need to change in Muslim world in order to make important, substantial changes and improvement in women's rights is, first of all, we need to look at the process of modernization. We cannot have modernization in these countries without democracy, without the participation of the middle class, without strong civil society. These are the things which are lacking. When we don't have civil society organizations, it means you don't have women's organizations that are grassroots, you know, connected to the real needs of women, who can pressure the governments for change. And the elites in these countries are not coming usually from within the societies. They are representing most of the time military, or look at the reformers and modernizers in the Middle East. Look at and compare also the differences. For example, look who got more success in changing women's rights. When you look at Turkey, Atatürk, his popularity, because he was seen as legitimate nationalist leader. He was not someone installed by outsiders. You know, he was seen loyal to people. So when he brought this modernization project, including changes and improvement in women's rights, although traditionalists opposed him, the reactionists, but they could not mobilize people against him. Look at Bourguiba in Tunisia. Bourguiba represented, again, not a military man, but a nationalist who fought for his country, who was who was popular among people, who was legitimate. Therefore, he was very successful. One of the first things he did was to change personal status code, personal status law, which pertained to substantial equal rights in the family structure, although grounded in Islamic Sharia and reforming Islamic Sharia, not complete replacement of it with secular law, but still a lot of, you know, ban on polygamy and change, one of the most progressive family law in the. But compare it with some reformers who, for example, the Shah of Iran, who was not seen as legitimate representative of people, who came to power by coup d'etat, by the CIA support and so forth. Therefore, although he was, and especially, unfortunately, some women who had very good intention, who were helping, trying, pushing him to bring about changes in women's rights, but his success was much limited than Tunisia, because the elite in Iran had such a wide gap between elite, westernized and modernizing elite, and masses of people, that therefore the mullahs, the reactionaries, the traditionalist patriarchal forces could mobilize people against the Shah and could make women's rights as a hostage to the question of loyalty to the nation, to the people, rather than to imperialism and so forth. And it looks like my time is over. So we need different elites, and the role of the state is very important, but we need the strengthening of civil society and especially strong women's movement. Because if women cannot gain their rights by themselves through involvement, and if we don't have pressure and changes from top down and also bottom up to complement each other, then change is going to be either very superficial and short-lived or no change at all. Thank you.
Thank you.